America, land of freedom. Seems like we're under attack by treason. America, what are you thinking? Seems like everyone's out somewhere drinking. America, God has blessed you. Even after the things that we've been through, America, I want a savior. But you gotta listen to who the Lord speaks to.
Welcome to the Manning Report. I am James David Manning, broadcasting from the city of New York, in a community formerly known as Harlem, but the name of this community has been changed to Outlaw. And by the way, after the trial has taken place, it will simply be known as Outlaw. We will not say Harlem any further, any longer. Going to be a wonderful sight. See tens of thousands of patriotic Americans in their military outfits and in their various garbs and flags and banners marching through the streets of Harlem. Never seen anything like that before. It's going to be great, and we're going to give God the praise that it shall take place. So bring your particular identity clothing, if you will. Bring your particular identity flag or placards or whatever. Bring them to Harlem, and we're going to march around Columbia University and march over to the church thereafter. Now listen, we need to talk about what Justice Clarence Thomas, he's not the Chief Justice, but Justice Clarence Thomas said over the weekend regarding the issue of eligibility, and asked by a New York congressman about being able to run for president if you're not American natural born citizen. And Justice Thomas had something to say about it. We'll try to get to it tomorrow. What I'm going to do now is broadcast an interview I did with the American political pundit. It's an African-American talk show, radio talk show that's widely listened to by a number of African-Americans, mainly they're Democrats, but it's an on-air and a very popular network, the African-American political pundit. And I was on air with them for about an hour and a half, and I'd like to let you listen to it. God bless you.
I'm glad that you're here, Reverend Dr. James Manning. Well, Rock, as they call you pundit, I guess they can just call me controversial from the word go. I suppose that would suffice to give me an adequate description. Well, first of all, let me just say thank you so very much for allowing me to be on your broadcast and part of your program. I'm indeed grateful that you have considered to have me here. And I pray that I can perhaps answer some questions or shed some light or share some of the things that are in my heart that people may know have a sense of who I am, or from a personal point of view, perhaps that they've not had the opportunity in an interchange or with asking questions as perhaps will be possible later on. But I'm delighted to be here tonight. I am indeed.
Well, thank you very much. And we have Hadley on the line, too. She's the co-host of the program, and I'm appreciative of the fact that you and the staff over there at the church had the opportunity to schedule this. Hadley, go right ahead.
Hello, Dr. Manning, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Hadley. Thank you so very much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and certainly it was a pleasure speaking with your wife. Prior to you coming aboard this evening, I had basically explained to our listening base what tonight's protocols would be. And here's what we're going to be doing. We're actually going to be starting out with you just giving us a little background about yourself, and then you can go ahead and start to explain exactly what's going on with this trial that's going to be taking place in May. If Pundit Rock has any questions, then what we will do after that is we're going to go ahead and let him ask his questions. So far, that's pretty much what we have set forth for this evening.
Very well. Would you like me to start at present or a little bit later?
Just start. If you can go ahead and start now and just give us your educational background.
All right. Well, first of all, I've been a pastor of the same church for the past 28 years, and it's located in the community of Harlem. In fact, we're smack dab in the middle of the Harlem community, just a couple of blocks away from where former President Clinton has his office. We're three blocks away from the Apollo Theater. And I've been the pastor of this church, a wonderful and vibrant congregation, for the past 28 years, the only church I've ever been the pastor of, pretty much officially a member of as well. I was educated at the College of New Rochelle with a bachelor's degree
and went on to Union Theological Seminary here in New York City, which has a conjunction program with Columbia University, which I'll be talking about a little bit later on. Indeed, my student identification card reads Columbia University because of the library programs and others that the Union and Columbia had with one another. They are right across the street from each other. Indeed, before enrolling in Union for my master's program as a pastor, I was torn about whether I should go to Columbia as a law student or whether I should go to Union. But I remember the Lord had done some wonderful things for me. Early on in my life, I had gone astray. I was working as a marketing representative for Procter & Gamble in the late 60s, early 70s, one of the best jobs anybody in my family had ever had. And I went afoul and ended up in prison and spent 3.5 years behind bars in two states, in the state of Florida, where I was convicted of burglary on Miami Beach, robbing homes out there in Miami Beach. And I was also convicted of, well, I had fenced some jewels to a small-time mafia type here in New York City. And he and I had a big fight that ended up in my being convicted of robbing him. And I was sentenced to 10 years to run concurrent with the burglary sentence that I had in the state of Florida. So I spent a total of 3.5 years serving a concurrent sentence in two states, Florida and the state of New York. And while in prison, I gave my life to the Lord. In fact, what I did was I felt so terrible about what I had done because I had not been raised to become the person I had ended up being. I started out my life in a pretty successful way, working as a marketing representative for Procter & Gamble, an excellent salary and housing benefits and a company car and that kind of a thing. But I became very angry listening to the rhetoric of Stokely Carmichael and Rap Brown, Huey Newton, and even the Reverend Adam Clayton Powell. And it was during the time of shortly after the death of Dr. King and the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, the social sexual revolution in America. I just became very angry, and I just walked off of a great job and began stealing, burglarizing homes. And my motto was, I would never burglarize a black home. I always burglarized other people's homes. And I don't mean for anyone to see that as racist, but I suppose it was at the time. But at any rate, once released from prison, or while in prison, I felt so bad about the fact that I had deserted my family during my process of crime and had deserted my children and was living with another woman when I was finally arrested, and I just felt so awful for what I had done and how I had lived. And I fell down on my knees one night, and I asked the Lord if he could forgive me. I didn't want to get out of prison. In fact, I didn't necessarily want to stay there, but it was never my intent, as God knows as I speak to you now. It was not my intent when I prayed, that he should get me out of prison. I just wanted to be relieved of the horrible pain I felt all over me every day for who I had become. I had become this terrible deserter of my family, a person who didn't have to steal but did. I thank God I never did drugs. And I just want the Lord to forgive me. Well, he did. And I spent the next 3 years in prison, and finally I was released. So when the opportunity came for me to go to graduate school, I was choosing between Columbia and Union. I was choosing between law and theology. And because God had been so good to me, I entered Union and received a master's degree from the Union Theological Seminary. I have gone on since then. That's been several years ago now, a couple of decades. And I have founded several schools here in the Harlem area. Going back about 15 years ago, during the ending segment of the horrific crack epidemic across America, it hit Harlem like a locust storm. I mean, from the late 80s, the late 70s rather, through the 80s. I mean, it was everywhere you looked in Harlem, somebody was addicted to crack or dying from AIDS. And early on, they didn't realize that AIDS was taking so many people out. I preached so many funerals during that period of time. And during the time that the great crack epidemic was taking place, the news people had discovered a young girl, I forget her age now, whether it was 7 or 9 years old, who was living in a room with her crack-addicted mother and her crack-addicted boyfriend that was only 2 blocks away from our church, 2 blocks walk, on the same street which our church is on. And that young girl had not been out of the house, I think, for 3 or 4 years, did not know what Christmas was, had not been to school, had not seen the light of day, had just been a prisoner of a wretched crack-addicted mother and boyfriend. And so when we discovered, found that going on, we began to canvass the neighborhood, and I opened a school for the young children in this community, a Christian-based school, and it's been operational ever since. We've since advanced it to a high school. I was doing some radio broadcasting back in the early 90s, and a young man who had become a part before the major problem with the Islamic jihadist and terrorist had exploded on the planetary scene. This young man had been a professor of theology at in Germany in one of its seminaries, and he had been drafted by the United Nations to work on tracking down international criminals. Even though he was a theologian, the United Nations brought him in because he did have police experience. And he was listening to our broadcast. He came to our church, joined our church while working at the United Nations, and he founded what is known as Otlaw Theological Seminary. Years later, that seminary went ahead and gave me, after I had done the work successfully, a doctorate degree in philosophy. So that represents a little bit about who I am and what I've been doing over the last 28 years.
Thank you so much for all the information. Now, can you give us, what we'd like to do now is find out what exactly is behind this trial that's coming up in May. If you could give us the finer details, just state your case.
Well, I believe, in fact, I know I have hard evidence and documented proof that Barack Hussein Obama did not attend Columbia University in the traditional, nor in the non-traditional, nor under any auspices of any foreign student interchange program with any other nation. He did not do that, and I can prove it 9 ways to Saturday. And I plan to bring that before the American people. I've called for a duly authorized trial with a duly authorized judge who has retired, who does have experience in being a judge in the federal level. And I plan to have attorneys, and I've sent out indictments, or will send out indictments. And we have a roster of witnesses. And we plan to conduct a trial under the auspices of the American grand jury proceedings and the U.S. Constitution.
So can you tell us, I think, when people hear about a trial, what is it about your trial that you think would eliminate it from being considered to be a, I don't know, I want to say kangaroo court or something that people shouldn't take very seriously?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, we've had that phrase used quite often. In fact, there have been several phrases, mock trial, moot trial, kangaroo court, railroad even. What we are attempting to do, because we believe that this trial will have a tremendous impact upon the American political, social, and religious scene, more specifically, it will have a tremendous impact historically, we are advising ourselves to take every precaution that this trial will stand, that the way it is conducted, its standards and practices, its respect for jurisprudence, its adherence to all other laws that the federal and state courts mandate for conducting a trial that it will indeed be appellate court proof. That is to say, if an appeal from the verdict of this trial is rendered unto a appellate court, it will stand the inspection of an appellate court. We're planning to do that. We're working as feverishly as we possibly can to dispel any notions that this is just a cracked-up kind of an event. We recognize that we have a great opportunity to serve the American people in a unique way, and we are spending precious, precious time, resources, and prayers to make sure that this is not a kangaroo trial, but indeed a court proceeding that will be respected by all people in the legal community.
And can you tell us what do you expect the outcome to be?
Well, the information clearly indicates guilty. Now, I think that perhaps the better way to answer that question is to give you a little bit about the layout of the trial. I plan to conduct the trial in three stages over a series of days. The stage number one would be to demonstrate that Obama is not a natural-born citizen in Article 2, Segment 1 of the Constitution that would permit him to actually serve as U.S. President. And we want to demonstrate that, not relying upon whether or not there's a birth certificate in a vault in Honolulu or not, that is not, or whether he was born in Kenya. Those matters may or may not exist, and we will not attempt to use those. What we will attempt to do, or what we will do, is prove through the U.S. constitutional mandates and the structure of the U.S. Constitution that only a natural-born citizen can serve as U.S. president. Thusly, Obama's mother, who was less than 18 years of age and could not convey citizenship to him at the time of his birth, whether he was born in Kenya or whether he was born in Honolulu, was irrelevant. The fact that his father, who he has admitted and has been documented that his father is Barack Obama Sr., who was a Kenyan and a British subject, there are two constraints on the life of Obama. One is that he cannot be a natural-born citizen because his mother was not old enough to convey citizenship. She was not of legal age. Therefore, his father, Barack Obama Sr., took precedent in that matter of a natural law, which makes him a Kenyan. Whether he was born in Honolulu or not, it doesn't really matter what the birth certificate says. The other item is that Barack Obama Sr.'s father was a subject of Kenya, which was a subject of the British Crown under the 1948 British Nationality Act, making Obama a dual citizen of both the British Crown and also of the Republic of Kenya. There is no way on God's earth Obama can be a natural-born citizen. Therefore, his presidency is illegal.
Okay. And can you give us some of the some additional information, the other aspects of your case beyond whether or not Barack Obama is a natural-born citizen?
Well, again, you have to be of a certain age to vote in America, and you have to be of a certain age to convey citizenship. And again, his father's precedence, because his father was not a citizen, that makes Obama not a citizen, because his father was of the age to convey citizenship. So that is an open and shut matter. It's not even an argument. It can be clearly demonstrated that the Supreme Court, they have refused to hear the matter, even though they understand the constitutional principles involved, and we'll deal with that a little bit later on in this broadcast. But I think that beyond that, we want to lay that foundation out first, because that then begins to determine why his trek at Occidental and why his mother, of course, immediately moved to Seattle after giving birth to him out of Honolulu, and then later married Lolo Shatoro, who was an Indonesian Muslim, and they spent 6 years together, and Obama spent 6 years in Jakarta, Indonesia, where he learned the Islamic language, and he was expatriated and was adopted by Lolo Shatoro. All of this is documented in his book, meaning that he gave up his citizenship, or his mother gave it up for him because he didn't have the right to do that. And he could have reclaimed it any time he wanted to, but when Lolo Shatoro adopted Barack Obama and changed his name to Barry Shatoro, he was no longer a citizen. The action is called expatriation. He became a citizen of Indonesia. When he came back from Indonesia, at the age of 10, he never bothered to repatriate himself, which would have meant he would have had to apply to the INS again. And at that point, he could have become a registered legal alien or very possibly a naturalized citizen, but certainly never the qualification of a natural-born citizen. We then moved through his high school records, where have been sealed, his time in Occidental College that has been sealed, but except I have talked to several people that attended Occidental in the same year in which he did. And then out of the blue, Obama transfers. Now, he admits in his book, Dreams from My Father, that he was a fun-loving, pot-smoking party animal with a C average at Occidental College. And just out of the blue, he's there for 2 years, and he transfers to Columbia University, which is one of the fifth most difficult school in America, if not on the planet, to get into. I mean, you got to have a 3.5 average to get into Columbia. Otherwise, you don't get considered. And even with the 3.5 average, there are thousands of students that are turned away every year from Columbia. Even though they meet the grade point average, they just can't get into that very, very difficult school called Columbia. Well, Obama waltzes into Columbia as a transfer student, no less, with a 2.3 average in the middle of a school year. Absolutely unprecedented. Never in the history of any major institution has anything of that nature ever taken place. We've done the research and the investigation and discovered that Obama's name does not appear in the student roster. The only place Obama's name appears is on the graduation program, but the head of the political science department, of which he received a degree in, does not remember ever seeing Obama. George Stephanopoulos, who was in the same program, ABC News, Good Morning America, doesn't remember seeing him. It's a very, very interesting, very, very interesting. And by the way, I was attending Union the same year as Obama. I was in a master's program. Obama was in a bachelor's program. I was in Harlem. Columbia University, a lot of people don't know, is in Harlem. I'm only seven blocks away from that school right this moment. I'm in our church building at present. I never saw him. I was very politically involved during those years. I was the secretary of the Baptist Ministers Conference, a conference of some 400 pastors within the New York City area. I never heard of him, never saw him, never heard anybody that heard of him. He's an enigma. He's a mystery. He's invisible. We're going to demonstrate that he wasn't there, but that indeed that he was recruited by the CIA and trained to be an operative to help the U.S. after the Soviets invaded the Afghanistan in 1979, and America could not actually send troops to help the Mujahideens fight the Soviet war machine. But the CIA was very integral, and Obama he fit right into the Punjab area. He fit right into the Muslim Islamic character of Pakistan and that border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. He understood Muslim cultures and food. He spoke the language, and he was integral in working with the Mujahideens, who later became the Taliban, and supplying arms, logistics, money. He was quite integral after an intense training period. And I suspect that training period could have lasted as long as a year and a half under the Reagan administration, no less, this took place. But we intend to prove.
Well, I do have a couple of questions, if I can just go backwards a little bit. I know that you had made mention of, what we clearly understand, which was that his father was from Kenya. So obviously citizenship could not have been conveyed by the father, not U.S. citizenship. But tell me a little bit more about the fact that the mother was so young and therefore she could not convey citizenship. Was that a state law or where is that coming from?
That's a part of the Constitution. You have to be a citizen of voting age to convey citizenship. You can give birth at any age. You have to have lived in America. Even if you're an American citizen, we would have had to have lived in America for a period of at least 14 years at the time of birth in order to convey citizenship. That is to say, if you've been out of America for 14 years, let's say living in Italy, for instance, and you've been living in Italy for 20 years, even though you were born an American citizen, you cannot convey that American citizenship to your child born in Florence if you've been out of America for 14 years. So it's a very intricate kind of statute within the Constitution, but it's fairly clear that you have to be of age and you have to have lived in America for a period of time in order to convey citizenship. Now, you can be a naturalized citizen, but natural born, there are two classifications, and the highest classification, when Chief Justice, or who became the Chief Justice, John Jay, and George Washington and others who were drawing up the Constitution, one of the things that they wanted to do after they had fought so tenaciously to extricate this nation from the tyranny of, from England, they wanted to make sure that whoever became the leader of this nation, and it was Chief Justice John Jay, it was just John Jay at the time, who later became the first Supreme Court Justice of America, wanted to make sure that absolutely no one would be given the immense power of the presidency of this nation who had a dual allegiance or had any kind of allegiance to any other nation, that they had to be a natural-born citizen. And that is the ultimate distinction. Now, there's naturalized, there's legal alien, there are several other distinctions of citizenship that's valid, but the natural-born one requires a much, much higher hurdle. And neither Obama's mother or his father at the time of the birth could convey that to him.
Okay. And the other question that I have has to do with your reference to him transferring to Columbia University with a 2.3 grade point average. If his scholastic records have been sealed, how did you get that information?
From the book Dreams from My Father. It's in there. That's where he stated it.
2.3 grade point average.
Well, he states that he was a C student.
Okay.
And so if you do the math, it could go in. But we know that it was 2.3. But he states in Dreams from My Father, he does not give the numerical grade point average, but he states that he was a C student, and he goes on to talk about he was a party animal and fun-loving, pot-smoking guy. We discovered that it was a 2.3.
Okay. And the other question that I would have before we have you go along stating your case would be, if I think most people that are aware of you are very much aware of you thanks to YouTube, and they've seen a number of your videos dating back to the Democratic presidential primaries. You've made a lot of statements since then with regard to Barack Obama's mother, and also with regard to African-American men and women. Do you ever think, you know, when you remember the things that you said in the videos or you view those, that perhaps because of those types of statements that you've made that have been very, very sensitive to the African-American community and about someone's mother, that you would be perceived less seriously, you know, by Americans?
I think that the statements have probably... they certainly have not diminished any level of seriousness of who I am. Perhaps there have been a great sense of consternation to a large number of people, and many have been insulted by the statements, but I don't think anyone has not taken me serious. I think that they recognize that there is certainly a sense of commitment to what I'm saying. And to address those issues, the matter... references that I made to his mother, I've explained, first of all, through 1,000 interviews I did during the 2008 Democratic and the general election, the primary and the election, general election, was that I, as a pastor, have made it a commitment to never say anything in my preaching, generally sermons, that God does not give me, and at least in the very interpretations I understand that God has given me to say. So I generally start my messages with thus saith the Lord, as the prophets of old have done. But also made it clear that all of the statements that I made were synonymous with biblical statements. For instance, John the Baptizer and Jesus, two cousins in the New Testament area, very clear when they talk to religious leaders. They call them snakes, they call them vipers, a brood of vipers, foxes. whited sepulchers, hypocrites of the first magnitude, just a series of lamentations and hurtling invectives that John and Jesus used. Now, a lot of people tend to disavow that's in the Bible, but it's there. And when I call Obama's mama white trash, I explain that in two ways. Number one, I grew up in rural North Carolina in the 50s and the 60s. And during that time, I graduated from a segregated high school. My growing up in rural North Carolina, generally in the 50s and early 60s, during the time in which Obama was born, any white woman that had relations with a black man in that general culture was considered a trashy woman. It was not like it is today. There's a different sense in America today and around the world of interracial relations. We all know that, but we also have to know that there were white water fountains. I saw them. There were colored water fountains. I saw them. And then there were trashy white women. I saw them as well. And I am not the progenitor of this. I simply spoke what was a nomenclature of the time in which Obama was born, in the 60s, and in Hawaii, of all places, where it is rare that black men were. Generally, the woman who had a relationship with a black man were usually trashy women. And I made that clear. I also made it clear that Jesus called the Pharisees whited sepulchers, which a sepulcher is a grave, tombstone, sort of a crypt. It's like, and he referred to them as a garbage dump. You people are nothing but a garbage dump. You're white on the outside, but on the inside, you're full of dead men's bones. And I made that analogous to my statements in a biblical sense to what I was expressing regarding Obama's mother. And it's true, too, by the way. She was indeed trash.
Well, I think, you know, just my personal opinion, I think that when you're trying to convey a message, I think that the way that you communicate to people can cause them to shut down. And you may very well have some very valid points to make, but I think when we talk about references to the African American community and certainly a sensitivity to the way that you speak about someone's mother, I think that that probably caused people to shut down and not want to hear your underlying message. That's just my personal observation. But I do want you to go ahead and continue. I know you were talking about the fact that you felt Obama was not attending Columbia University, and you were starting to, or, you know, develop the whole theory behind the fact that he may have been working for the CIA. Can you pick up your narrative there?
Yeah, he did not attend Columbia. It is clear, and there is no defending. There isn't the slightest possibility that he was there under any of the, as I said before, auspices that could possibly have been during those years. So I think that it is fraudulent for Columbia University, who during the primary, by the way, and the general election, and even up until the time of the inauguration, was as quiet as a church mouse regarding what would have been their most famous graduate. No student of Columbia has ever become the president of the United States. Now, Dwight Eisenhower was president of Columbia as a school at one point for about a year or so, 2 years, but nothing really significant took place. He later became president of the United States. But Obama would have been the first student to have reached a major plateau of receiving the nomination of a major party. Columbia University was silent. We've gone through the records of Columbia's newspapers, all of its alumnus information, and during the entire 2008 campaign, the winning of the nomination, even the winning of the election on November the 4th, Columbia said not one word. They wrote not one article. They made not one statement of support. Finally, when they were asked about it, the one statement they did state, well, we didn't want to get involved in political and politics and try to influence an election one way or the other. What a lie. But at any rate, how could you have your most famous student and you go absolutely silent? And they're silent now, pretty much, about Obama. mainly because they know that he wasn't there. But it was fraudulent for them because Michael Sovereign, who was the president of Columbia at the time, and the trustees of Columbia, they know that they reached a deal with the CIA, and that when Obama ran for president, that he was not a natural-born citizen and that he was under scholarship from Arthur Dental as a foreign student. It was their duty to inform the American people that you're getting ready to elect someone who does not meet our traditional constitutional standards. Now, one can argue that, well, you know, all right, listen, he was raised here in America. He spent a lot of his time here in America. The people liked him. Let it go. That's fine. I can agree with that. I don't have an argument with that. However, what I do want to say is that the law is the law. And if the law says that you must reach a certain category of citizenship in order to participate in the most powerful office on the land, I think the law ought to be upheld. The other thing is that there are laws on the books that prevent schools from just popping up and issuing degrees to people and sending them out onto an unsuspecting public. For instance, if an organization just rose up and handed out a medical degree to some John Doe and said, all right, now you are now a physician, you know, with practices as a neurosurgeon, yet he never went to class, nobody ever saw him, that he never, you know, and then send him out into the hospital. This man doesn't know the first thing about neurosurgeon. That's illegal, and the laws and the federal and state laws prohibit that kind of activity. That's what Columbia did, and they should not sit silent while this charade is being manifested on the American populace. It should not happen. It should not happen.
And so we've gotten to the point where you're talking about basically you're alleging that Columbia University then was complicit in this entire thing. Is there anything else that you want to say, you want to mention?
Yeah, I would. I think that referencing your earlier statement and suggestion about what is best policy to appeal to the masses in terms of gathering people to your point of view or forcing people to shut down. I'd like to say that I've been a pastor and a public speaker for more than 28 years, and I've spoken in many venues, and I've been trained by some of the best schools I think that America has to offer. One of my complaints against African-American or black leadership, and especially when it comes to pastors, is that I see here in Harlem, 99% of them who have decent churches live in white communities, and they drive in their fancy cars on Sundays, and they pick up huge offerings from poor people who do all kinds of work to bring offerings to the church, and then they drive out. I live in community. I've lived here for 28 years. I plan to stay a member of the Harlem community. But moreover, I've noticed that over the last 40 to 50 years, the black or African-American people on this present cadre of leadership, and you can name any one of them who black people tend to worship, that we have gone from bad to dismal in terms of a national group. Ebony Magazine, Johnson Publishing, a very vibrant magazine in the early 60s, and still is to some degree today, published that there were 40 million Americans that were living in black people living in America in the 1960s. And today the Census Bureau indicates that there are only 31 million. We're down 9 to 10 million in just 40 years. I spent 3.5 years locked up with literally thousands of black men. When I first went into the penal system, the prison system in 1974, I believe it was, I'm sorry, 75, there were about 200,000 people in prison in America, from Fort Leavenworth, to Alcatraz, to Sing Sing, to some of the major prisons, and one was Attica here in New York today. And so today there are over 2 million black men in prison. There has been a 200% increase in men going to prison under the present leadership of the present black leaders. Black preachers have been so ineffective that the prison population, now you can say it's the white man's prison complex, or many people can take the general, go down that general road, that the white man is holding you down. And I have just one response to that. When I left home in North Carolina, I have three other brothers. They're all younger than me. And I used to beat them up in fights. We, you know, just boys doing what we do. Well, three of my brothers, two of them, one of them is 6'7", the other is 6'5". And when I went back home after being away from North Carolina for 10 years, they had grown up. They were 40 pounds heavier than me. And they said, hey, you want to do to us what you used to do to us? You think you can beat us up now? I couldn't do it because they grew up, became men, and they beat me. So this continual refrain that the white man is holding us down is a self-fulfilling prophecy. To say that the white man holds you down means that he must be better than you. He must be bigger than you. When on earth are you ever going to be able to beat him? And then finally, I spent day and night, night and day, 3.5 years trapped in some of the worst prisons, maximum security prisons on the planet. And all I did was talk to black men. And the hatred that has instilled and instilled that has been taught them by the black leadership, whether it's black churches, Jesse Jackson's types, Al Sharpton types in particular, has robbed them of their potential, their intellectual strength, their ability to integrate themselves into this wonderful nation called America, because they are constantly told how awful this nation is, how awful white people are. And by the way, you know, I left a very high-paying executive job with a Fortune 500 company with a company car, an expense account, and housing allowance, Procter & Gamble, because I, too, became influenced by what is the general rhetoric of the black leadership, the kind of rhetoric that most 99% of the black people like and hate what I do. But I'm a living example that it has destroyed the black family. 70% of the homes are headed by women today, where when I grew up, my daddy and every other man, the child I knew, daddy was home. He may not have had a great job, but we had fathers in the house. We built great schools in the 40s and the 50s during the Jim Crow period. Shaw University, A&T, Fisk University, Howard, Hampton. We built great churches during that period of time. Now all we do is build death. We co-sign rap music. We've seen the worst atrocities of crack and AIDS. And you tell me that I'm wrong for speaking this truth about black America. I speak it because I love people. But they need to hear the truth. They just need to hear the truth.
Well, I think that there's certainly nothing wrong with, you know, bringing out the truth. You know, I don't have an argument with you with regard to that. I do want to say, though, that I do feel that certainly people that are not doing what they're supposed to be are in every single race that we have, certainly in the world, you know, not just in the United States of America. I was just thinking that just the people that I've spoken to in the past have said, well, I couldn't get past what he said at the beginning to even get to the message, and I just thought that I should bring that forward.
America, land of freedom. Seems like we're under attack by treason. America, what are you thinking? Seems like everyone's out somewhere drinking. America, God has blessed you. Even after the things that we've been through, America, I want a savior. But you gotta listen to who the Lord speaks to. Land of the red, white, and blue. 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 America, God's voice is speaking. better listen or you'll find yourself sinking. America, we do love you. Stop making decisions that hurt you. America, God has blessed you. Even after the things that we've been through, America, let's take our land back. America, we love you, America. 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 America, yeah.
We love America,
yeah.
We love America,
yeah.